little piece from the paper in the Morning News, March the 1st, 1895. David, it's titled, Three Peddlers Arrested. David Grodeski, David Wurzig, and S. Felstem, Hebrew peddlers, were arrested yesterday morning for selling a patent window cleaner without a license, and they will have a hearing this morning. The papers in those days always identified if they were Jews, they were Hebrews, they're blacks, they were colored, but they always identified the nationality, accepted. Because you were Scotch-Irish, they didn't say that. If you're a WASP, they didn't say that, but we soon got out of that. And then another interesting little item I have, Peter Kalm was a Swede who traveled from the Delaware area on up and down this coast, and he wrote his memoirs, and here's what he said. This is around the early part of the 18th century. And he wrote his impressions of Jews. I don't know where he saw them. He may have seen them in New York. Jews never cook on Saturday. Commonly, they ate no pork. Yet I've been told by several trustworthy men that many of them, especially the young Jews, when traveling, did not hesitate the least about eating this or any other meat that was put before them. This is now around early 1700. And then Peter Kalm went to a synagogue, and he was put in a seat set apart for strangers. He said the rabbi read the service partly in Hebrew and partly in rabbinical dialect, whatever that is. Men and women dressed in English fashion. Men wore hats, did not once take them off. The galleries were reserved for women, men below. The men wore white cloth over their heads, which is perhaps to represent sackcloth. Richer men had richer clothes. The rabbi stood in the middle of the synagogue, which would lead me to believe it was a Sephardic. I think the middle would be the Sephardic type synagogue. The rabbi stood in the middle of the synagogue and read with his face to the east. He spoke, however, so fast as to make it almost impossible for anyone to understand him. This is Peter Kalm, who traveled up and down, particularly spent a great deal of time with his Swedish friends in Wilmington. Well, now, tonight, we're going to talk about the beginnings of Jewish history. And this is from about 1655 to 1870. And I always come up with the question, an old, old question, about who is a Jew. Now, I was reading a preface to a new book the other day called The Jew in Politics, American Politics, written by a young man, a man by the name of Stephen Isaacs, whose father happens to be the president of the News Journal now. So I was telling Mr. Isaacs, Mr. Norman Isaacs, the father, that I thoroughly disagreed with his son. That's a good way to begin off with the boss. I thoroughly disagreed with his son in the premise that he also raised the same subject, who was a Jew in history. And he said that for the purpose of the book, he was accepting only those Jews who admitted they were Jews. Well, I don't think you can do that. So then I asked Mr. Isaacs, I said, suppose you were writing a book about the Jew in English politics. What would you do with Mr. Disraeli? You couldn't ignore him at all. And he said, well, he let me argue with his son. So we come up, when you talk about Jew in American history, you come up to the question, who is a Jew? What yardstick do we use in determining who was or who wasn't a Jew? I have several. First, there's the individual who says he was Jewish. And later on, I'll read you a direct quote from the earliest Jews in this area who admitted they were Jews. That's very important. Then, does the community regard him as Jewish? I think that's important. But you have to weigh that to see as to how important it is at any particular time. Also, in discussing Jews in American history, you mustn't fall into the trap of concluding that a person is Jewish merely by Jewish-sounding names. For example, Israel, Israel. I don't think Israel, Israel was Jewish. Also, in Philadelphia, there was a Jewish family named Bush. Then there was a family here in Wilmington, almost at the same time, named Bush. And I think it would be an error to say that the Wilmington Bushes were Jews. Then, of course, from an historical point of view, you have to develop the importance of objectivity in discussing or evaluating an historical personality who is either regarded as Jewish or distinguishes himself as Jewish. For example, you may have prejudices against the people I do. I don't know why. To me, a Jew who becomes converted to Christianity just rubs me the wrong way. It's a little bit of chutzpah on my part. You know, what's in my business? But nonetheless, when you read American history and you find a Jew and you find out he's been converted, you say to yourself, why? Why do you have to do it? But when you're handling history, you've got to try not to color your evaluation. And that would be like the case of a man named Moses Levy, whom I'll come back to in a minute. The Jewish story in Delaware begins years and years and years ago in 1655. And that was 4 years after the Dutch came down to the Delaware Valley and settled what is now Newcastle. So very quickly, I'll just give you a few dates about what was happening here. There was 1632, the Dutch came to what is now Lewis. And they came to Lewis because in 1609, Henry Hudson, in the employ of the Dutch, was trying to find a northwest passage to China or the Indies. He came up the Delaware Capes. He saw on one side what is now Lewis, Rehoboth, the other side, Cape May. And then he wanted to go farther up. He found there were shoals. He wrote that there were whales in the Delaware Bay. And then he decided this was not it, and he left, came around, went on up north to what is now the Hudson River. So he discovered all that land in the name of Holland. That was 1609. 1632, the Dutch came. They established a little village at near Lewis, Delaware, which they called Zwanendale, and then it was burned out, destroyed by the Indians within a year, so there was nothing left. 1638, the Swedes now come. They're going up the Delaware. They turned in at what's now the Christina River. They come to some rocks, and there they established what is now the settlement of Wilmington. In 1651, the Dutch come in to what is now Newcastle, and established what place called Fort Casimir. And then we have the fight between the Swedes and the Dutch. And then in 1654, the Swedes are kicked out by the Dutch, who were then led by Peter Stuyvesant, the number one, the first anti-Semite in the United States, first known one in what is now New York, was then New Amsterdam. Now, thanks to the Dutch archives, we know more about these early Jews in this area, comparatively speaking, than we know about Jews at later dates. For example, there were three Jews, Abraham de Lucina or Lucena, Salvador Dandrida, Jacob Cohen, who identified themselves as members of the Jewish faith. This is rather interesting and important. And they asked Stuyvesant if they could come down to what was known as the South River, which was Delaware, to trade. And Stuyvesant refused. Later on, he said that two Jews could go down there to the South River to dispose of their goods. Now, these three Jewish pioneers had already shipped their goods down here to present-day Newcastle. So two Jews came down, Isaac Israel and Isaac Cardoza. That would be late in 1655. Now, this story has many, many ramifications, and I would suggest, if anybody was really interested in some difficult research, this might be one segment of Jewish history that could be definitely researched. In other words, the Jews who, when they refused, they appealed to Jews in Amsterdam. The Dutch were very friendly to Jews, and there was an exchange of correspondence between the Dutch in Amsterdam and Peter Stuyvesant, with who, in effect, the Dutch told Stuyvesant to behave himself and stop being this nonsense against Jews. And this whole story has never been thoroughly researched. Now, I have a book here called, it's called Annals of Pennsylvania, which includes Delaware. And it has this rather interesting first reference here about this particular incident. This is 1655. A petition is presented. This book, by the way, just details as the years go by. It says here, a petition is presented to the Director General by Abraham Lucena, Salvador Dandrida, which is a different spelling than I have, and Jacob Cohen, quote, in their own name, I think it's rather interesting, in their own name and on behalf of the Jewish nation residing at New Amsterdam, showing that the suppliants on February the 13th, 1655, were permitted by the director of the West India Company to travel, reside, and trade here as other inhabitants and to enjoy all the privileges. Soliciting, therefore, most reverently that Your Honor will not obstruct them, this is to Stuyvesant, will not obstruct them, but permit that they agreeably to the obtained privilege in Holland may travel and trade on the South River with the same liberty as the other inhabitants. And then each member of the council of Stuyvesant gave his opinion on the subject, and Stuyvesant and a man named Montaigne said, it cannot be granted for weighty reasons. Sounds kind of modern, for weighty reasons. And then another man named De Sill thought, as they, the Jews, had embarked some goods for the South River, it might not be becoming to grant a permit, but to wait orders from the directors. Then there was another friend of Mr. Stuyvesant named Tien Hovind, and he thought it would be prejudicial to the trade and population of this country, and therefore at present, during the winter, ought to be rejected and carefully and fairly represented to the directors, and that a young man for the present of that nation may depart for the South River with a few cargoes without being drawn into precedent. Well, then the years went by, and they finally were given permission. But now I'm here in the year 1656, and according to the annals of the Dutch, it says here one sentence, Jews are prohibited from trading on the South River. And this is found in what's known as the Albany Records. And then later on, in 1657, we come across an incident of a Jew by the name of Isaiah Mesa, who spelled his name M-A-M-E-S-A. Isaiah Mesa, a Jew, remonstrates, quote, that he found himself aggrieved by a sentence of the 14th April last, 1657, pronounced by the Vice Director on the South River, New Netherland, J.P. Jaquette, and counsel relative to a dispute between him and some of the Swedes. And he desires to appeal, granted, provided he makes, as usual, a deposit of 12 guilders, which being performed, he is commanded, as the sheriff of the Swedes is on his departure, to deliver his conclusion within 24 hours to enable us to give us a decision. This sounds awfully complicated. There are more details in it in the Albany Records. If you want to know who Jaquette was, he was one of the early Swedes, later became involved with the Dutch. The Jaquette family became very well known in Delaware in the Revolution. And the next time you go down to the Kent Manor Inn, that's where Mr. Jaquette lived. Don't hold the present owners of the Kent Manor, but that's known as Longhook, and that's where the Jaquette family lives. So what I'm trying to point out is early in the 1650s, there was a great deal of conflict between the Jews and the Dutch. Now the story of Isaac Mesa is sometimes felt apparently he had a treaty with the Indians at Fort Casimir, which is Newcastle, which established fair prices for trade. And then a month later, he had some trouble with Jaquette and the other members of the council, and how this problem was solved, I don't exactly know. But all this is fragmentary, but it deserves attention from some student, not only because it was the beginning of Jews in this area, but also because it reflects antagonism to the Jews from the Dutch officials here. And we definitely know that these men were identified as Jews. I would say, looking back over the long history of Delaware, going back way back to the Swedes, we've had very few incidents of anti-Semitism. I would say that, oddly enough, during the Dutch regime, up until the English came, there was, most of it was right packed in those era of the Dutch rule. But then there was a very interesting character named Plakoy, who was a Bohemian, and he developed a Mennonite, and he developed a colony, idea of a colony, a communal colony, very similar to the kibbutz. And he got permission to come over to this country, and he was going to have a settlement down near Lewis, and he invited a lot of people from the lowlands of Europe to come, except all intractable people, those were his words, intractable people, such as the English, the stiff-necked Quakers, the Puritans, the usurious Jews, and Catholics. Other people could come to his settlement. Well, he came. He came, and he established, Plaquoy established his colony down in Sussex County, in the vicinity of Lewis, and everything was going all right until the English moved in, kicked the Dutch out, and also kicked out Plaquoy and burned his village and colony. And last I heard of Mr. Plaquoy, he was wandering somewhere around up near Germantown, Philadelphia, and he was taken in by none other than the Quakers, the various people whom he didn't want in his village. Now, with the coming of the English, things were a little more settled for Jews. However, I can't find too much in the way of Jews in this area, three counties in the Delaware, during the early arrival of the English. Now, William Penn came, and he had a very interesting attitude towards Jews. Now, Penn was a stiff-necked Quaker, and he was in trouble over in England. He was making trouble against the crown. And so the king, King Charles II, gave him a big tract of land, which we call Pennsylvania. And William Penn was a very smart real estate man. He was going to establish Philadelphia. And he knew that he couldn't work it out unless he had access by the way of the Delaware River and Bay. And so he went to his friend, James, Duke of York, who owned the three counties, what we call Delaware. And he said, how about giving them to me? So James then gave him two leases, each for 10,000 years. One was the northern part of Delaware, and the other was the southern part. And so William Penn now controlled all of Pennsylvania and the three counties. But when he came here, he was very much interested in the Indians. And he studied the Indians. He had a very good relationship with the Indians. But he thought they were Jews. He thought they were the remnants of the lost tribes. And one of his secretaries, Logan, was extremely interested in Jews and also in Hebrew. And the records show that Logan's library had many Hebrew books, and I suspect that even Logan could write and probably read biblical Hebrew. But Penn did promise freedom of conscience and religion in this area, which was unusual. But unfortunately, he required religious oaths of office. And so now we have very little evidence of Jews in Delaware during the Revolution. But now we come to our first constitution in Delaware in 1776, and this was an amazing constitution. This was a constitution written during a war, during a rebellion, and they promised a free press, which is unusual, no established religion, but they said in the first constitution of our state, which was adopted 200 years ago next year, that if you had a public office, you had to take the following oath. I do profess faith in God, the Father, and in Jesus Christ, his only Son, and in the Holy Ghost, one God, blessed forevermore. And then you had to subscribe to the Old and the New Testament. So they did throw in the Old Testament. But there was no established religion, and no clergyman could hold office in Delaware. But now in 1792, we began to see the light, and this was very interesting. How they got around to this, is another subject for some kind of research, because our second constitution said there shall be freedom of religion and, quote, no religious test shall be required as a qualification to any office or public trust under this state. Now, usually the Quakers would object, who were many Quakers in Delaware during the Revolutionary War and after, while they would object to loyalty oaths, these kind of oaths. Nonetheless, they could hold office, and they did hold office and take this oath. But in 1792, we changed the Constitution, we had a new Constitution, and abolished the religious oath. Now, for example, there was a very interesting man down in Lewis, whom you probably heard of, we talk about him once in a while, by the name of Daniel Nunez. Now, I came across Nunez's some years ago, and I was wandering around St. Peter's Church, which is Episcopal Church in Lewis, going around the graveyards, and I see this name, Nunez. And it struck me. It was about as Jewish a name as Cohen and Levy And it was definitely a Sephardic name. I had read about the Nunez going into England and Georgia and over in New Jersey, and I wonder how this Daniel Nunez came here to Delaware. And I discovered he was an office holder. He was a member of the General Assembly, so he had to take this oath of office. He was he belonged to the various conventions during the Revolutionary War. But I couldn't establish whether he was Jewish or not. His family has some beautiful Jewish names, like Hannah Nunez. There was Daniel Nunez, Esther Nunez. Also, there's a book called Sussex County Records, which has a great deal about the Nunez family. They married into the Fisher family, which is one of the first families of Sussex County. They married into the Collick family, which was then one of the leading families, which may or may not have been Jewish. I did come across a little item about a man named Shepherd Collick, K-O-L-L-O-C-H, a colonial printer who was born in Lewis and then went to New Jersey and flourished during the Revolutionary War. And this little note of a book dealer says, Shepherd Collick, a Jewish printer. And that's all. That's the most tantalizing thing I ever found. I have a book home by a man named Isaac Collins, who was also a Delawarean, who learned his printing in Delaware and also went to New Jersey. Shepherd Collick went to New Jersey to work and print with him, but I can't find out any more. But there is a well-known family down in Sussex County called the Collicks. Well, the question came up, was Daniel Nunez actually Jewish? Was this the right name? So I assumed that he was, and every time I wrote about it, some of the hidebound people in Sussex County would write me, you know, for protesting letters. Then one day, having nothing else to do, I was reading one of the most dull diaries of a surveyor named Watson. Mr. Watson surveyed the southern boundary of Delaware, from Fenwick Island over to the west. And I'm just reading this, going along, and you know, I did this, I did that, I stopped the most uninteresting diary, and all of a sudden, around 17450 or thereabouts, he says, I went to this tavern, I went to Lewis, and I spent the night at the tavern of Daniel Nunez the Jew. And so all of a sudden, it hit me right away. This was the same Daniel Nunez we're talking about. He was a tavern keeper. And so whether Mr. Nunez tried to get some protective coloration under the Anglican Church or not, nonetheless, the community regarded him as Jewish, and for better or for worse. But apparently, he was highly regarded in Sussex County, because he was a very important man in the church. He was a vestryman, and he was elected to a number of public offices. I used to assume that he came up here from Georgia, but later I read Dr. Marcus, that he may have come down from New Jersey. But I could see where you would settle, let's say, in Lewis, and then it was a seaport, and you would settle there, open a tavern, go into business, and then decide what's the use of being a single Jew, so I'll become the best thing possible there, an Anglican, which was the leading religion. But there are wills in Georgetown and Dover, there are parish records available, and this would be another interesting project for someone to dig and dig to see how the Daniel Nunez family came to Delaware, whether by way of Georgia or from New Jersey. Now, I came across I have a book called Letters of the Ridgely Family. And that was made possible by a delightful lady in Dover, Mrs. Mabel Ridgely. And every once in a while, I just go through it, and I came across this. I always go in a book by the index first. I looked up Jew, and sure enough, there was a letter from Miss Mary Ridgely, which was one of the leading families of Kent County, Miss Mary Ridgely of Philadelphia, to Mrs. Ann Ridgely of Dover, February the 20th, 1805. And she writes, Andrew Hamilton is in England, where his uncle has given him an estate and 1,000 guineas for the purchase of a carriage upon his marriage to a very rich Jewess. And that was a little tantalizing. This Andrew Hamilton is sometimes mixed up with a James Hamilton, but I suspect his father was Andrew Hamilton, who was the great lawyer of Philadelphia who defended Peter Zenger. Now, Andrew Hamilton I had Wilmington connections, I had Newcastle County connections. And then I discovered that Andrew Hamilton II was the one who probably married Abigail Franks of Philadelphia. She left the Jewish faith for the Anglican Church, though her father, David, is said to have continued contributing to the synagogues in Philadelphia. Now, if you're going to get into a study of the Franks family in Philadelphia, you've really got problems on your hand, because there are all kinds of Davids of various generations, but it's a very interesting one. And here, the reason I cite this is that here is an attitude of a Ridgely to another Ridgely in Dover as early as 1805 about a Hamilton marrying a very rich Jewess, expecting perhaps some snide remark, but not there at all. Now, one day I was reading the life of Willard Hall. Willard Hall was a great man of Delaware. He is known as the father of our public school system. He was a federal judge. He had a lot of courage. I'll tell you why I think he had a lot of courage. He was judge in Wilmington in 1865, and there were three men in Georgia, Southerners, killed four or five Union soldiers, and they were tried before a military court. And these Southerners claimed that they should have been tried before a civil court. That was a very touchy subject during the Civil War, particularly with political prisoners being tried in the North before military courts, which were definitely prejudiced. So these Southerners then got a writ of habeas corpus somehow in the District Court of Delaware. I think because they were put over in Fort Delaware and Pepatch Island for a while. And Willard Hall heard the case and then released the men. And he said they should not have been tried before a military court, but before a civil court. That took a lot of courage. Well, now, Willard Hall, in his memoirs, writes about the great lawyers he knew in Delaware. He writes about Thomas McKean. He writes about it Edward Tillman. And he writes having been alongside of Moses Levy in the Delaware courts. He says they were all distinguished and practiced at our bar, meaning the bar of Delaware. So at the first glance or second glance, Moses Levy would sound very much like a Jewish name. You couldn't get anything more Jewish than Moses Levy. But then you find out as you read that Moses Levy was not Jewish. He'd been converted and didn't want to be identified as a Jew. So what do you do in a case like that in writing about Jewish history? Do you say that Moses Levy, a Jew with a Jewish name, practiced here, was the first Jew we know to have practiced law in Delaware? Well, at first you might drop it, but then you come across the fact that his political enemies, despite what Moses Levy didn't want to be identified as a Jew, his political enemies identified him as a Jew and attacked him as a Jew. And so he was regarded as a Jew by many in Philadelphia, and certainly by many in Wilmington, in the political battles between the Federalists and their opponents. And so Moses Levy, in my opinion, has a very definite role in Jewish history. He had a brother named Samson, and then I find a letter from Samson to Moses, dated 1779, from Newcastle, Delaware. So Newcastle was the they had a county court in Newcastle in those days, and he probably was in Newcastle on court business. I came across a very tantalizing story of a Daniel Levy, an Irish Jew, identified as an Irish Jew, who died in a hospital somewhere in this area, having worked on the Chesapeake and Delaware Canal somewhere during the 1820s. Now, who Daniel Levy was, it's just a name that goes across the stage just like that and gets lost. Then, of course, there's a fascinating story of the Solich family who lived here and later went up to Philadelphia and to the South. And I find that I have in one of my records, I have a Jacob de Silva Solich, who with his brother Daniel had a country store I have on 3rd Street between King and French. Jacob de Silva Solich was born 1780, came to the United States from England around 1803, and he and his brother settled in Wilmington, advertised their wares to the general public, and proclaim their Jewishness. This is very important. Proclaim their Jewishness by stating in their ads in the New Wilmington newspapers, no business transacted on the seventh day. It's also reported that Jacob Solis married Charity Hayes. The marriage took place on what is known as the Stroud Farm on West Front Street. And the tradition is, story goes, that just before the wedding, they went over to the fields and they chopped down some trees for the poles for the chuppah. There was no such thing in those days as a Jewish community, and I'm sure that the brother Solis was socially tied into Philadelphia. Eventually, Daniel went to Philadelphia and became a shochet. Jacob remained behind for a while and then moved to New Orleans, where he...